Welcome to your weekly constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
There's trouble down in North Carolina. You've probably heard about it. There's a great furor in the press because of a statute recently passed by the state legislature and signed by North Carolina Governor McCrory. It's a statute that was passed specifically in reaction to a local ordinance passed by the city of Charlotte. Now, the local ordinance purported to protect the rights of LGBT people and purported to allow them to use bathrooms of their choice, transgendered people, bathrooms of their choice. And it was this last provision, especially, that prompted reaction in Raleigh. And the state acted very, very quickly to quash this ordinance and to even provide that such ordinances will not be allowed in the future. That is, if the city of Charlotte or the city of Raleigh or the city of Durham want to pass such ordinances in the future, they may not do so, because now only the state is going to determine the level of protection for minorities within the state of North Carolina. And the state further said that people are going to have to use bathrooms that are consistent with the gender they were born with rather than with the gender they currently identify with. Now, as you might guess, this has prompted great controversy. It's prompted reactions from across the nation. Bruce Springsteen and Ringo Starr both canceled concerts in the state. PayPal canceled a planned expansion of several hundred new jobs in the state. Other corporations have expressed reluctance to continue operations in the state or to expand their operations there. Other state governments have said they're no longer going to travel in North Carolina. It's a big mess. And in fact, it looks like there's an economic boycott being mounted. Now, the people in Raleigh have been defending themselves. They've said that they've been misconstrued. They've said that they've been the subject of a campaign of lies. What's the truth here? And more relevantly to our inquiry, what is the constitutionality of North Carolina's statute? With me is my buddy from the Air Force Academy. His name is Doug McKechnie. And we're going to talk about all those things. And in fact, we're even going to compare it to some conversations we've had recently about some statutes that you might have confused this with, the so-called RFRAs, or the Religious Freedom Restoration Acts. As we'll see, this is not exactly a RFRA, but I'll let Doug tell you about that.
My name is Doug McKechnie, and I'm an assistant professor, and I teach constitutional law at the United States Air Force Academy.
That's right. And you've got a disclaimer you need to give, don't you?
I do. My views are my own and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the United States Air Force, the Department of Defense, or the United States government.
And how long have you been out there, Doug, at the Air Force Academy?
This is my second year.
And you're still an assistant professor. So, I mean, have you offended someone?
Well, maybe that's why I'm stuck at assistant, but I put in for promotion and I'm hoping to move up the chain.
Well, maybe you can impress everybody so much today that we'll assist you in that endeavor. What are we talking about today?
Today we're going to be talking about the new North Carolina, the new law that was passed in North Carolina, and the backlash with regard to taking away Charlotte's ability to pass an ordinance protecting LGBT people from discrimination.
Right. This is obviously very familiar because it's been much in the news, but it also strikes me it's very familiar because you and I have discussed on at least one occasion before, probably more than that, the so-called RFRAs, these Religious Freedom Restoration Acts. This sounds something like that. Is that what we're talking about here?
You know what? It's interesting. I think a lot of people in the media have been conflating RFRAs and this law that North Carolina passed, but they're actually quite different. Mm-hmm. RFRAs are typically an attempt to protect businesses from allegations of discrimination based on sexual orientation when the business owner has a truly held religious belief. But this is something different. This is Charlotte, North Carolina, enacting an anti-discrimination ordinance that protected LGBT people and the state's reaction to that ordinance. So it's somewhat of a different
okay.
idea.
So the starting point for this case is that the city of Charlotte wants to enact a local ordinance where they're protecting the civil rights of LGBT people, and that ordinance gets passed.
Mm-hmm.
But now the state of North Carolina, the state government, decides that maybe it wants to have something to say about this ordinance.
Yeah, so Charlotte had had an anti-discrimination ordinance on the book for about 2 decades. Initially, the ordinance protected people from discrimination based on things like race, color, religion, national origin. That was updated. Indeed, it might have been more than 2 decades. Maybe it was 3 or 4 decades, almost back to the 60s, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's when a lot of those statutes were passed. I mean, they were passed in the wake of Jim Crow. Yeah.
And now the state, however, did not have the same sort of protection from discrimination, but Charlotte had it on the books for quite a while. They updated it ever so slightly throughout the last 40 years, adding a couple classes of protected people. And most recently, they extended that protection from the anti-discrimination protection. They extended to LGBT people, and that was in February of 2016. So it already their ordinance already included protection from discrimination based on race, age, religion, and sex. The new ordinance included gay, lesbian, and transgender people in that protection.
Right. And so in one sense, this could be considered just a continuation of a decades-long process. In fact, I think that's the way a lot of these anti-discrimination ordinances and statutes have gone, is they'll start out, for example, barring racial discrimination, and then down the road they'll add, you know, gender discrimination, and down the road they'll add, you know, some sort of other discrimination that the people decide is invidious or bad. And so these statutes have tended to grow over the years. And so I guess that was just the next step in the growth of this statute.
It was. And the other change in the statute or the ordinance that the city enacted was that it allowed transgendered residents to use either a men's or women's bathroom. And so often you see bathrooms that are available to the public, and they are designated either the men's room or the women's room. And the new ordinance allowed transgendered residents to choose which bathroom they wanted to use, depending on their gender identity.
That brings us to the T in LGBT. We've gotten so used to the acronym that I suppose we should probably remind ourselves of what it stands for. Lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered, I think, are the most common uses or common words that are used to form that acronym. And that last category you're pointing out has sort of come to the forefront of this. Not only have the other categories been added to the anti-discrimination ordinance in Charlotte, but the transgendered people are being brought front and center, and a very, very hot button issue was apparently included in this bill about the use of transgendered bathrooms. Or what exactly does the bill say?
So the bill essentially allows, or the ordinance, so within the jurisdiction of Charlotte, the city of Charlotte, it allowed transgendered residents in Charlotte to use either the men's or the women's bathroom, depending on the gender that they identify with. So and I think it's important to step back, and I certainly am not an expert in this area. And so I'm going to kind of tread lightly, but I think it's important to understand, or to at least have some ground rules with regard to what we're talking about when we talk about gender identity and sex and gender and the difference between the two.
Sure.
And my understanding is that typically when we use the words gender and sex, although they're often used synonymously, when we're talking about gender identity and transgendered people, sex is the anatomy or the reproductive system that you're born with. And then gender is how you identify with regard to how you live your life and the social roles that you you identify with, and the distinction between men and women from a social perspective.
So it's not just all about sex.
That's right. It's not – gender is not about necessarily your anatomy. Gender is more about the social roles that we expect from men and women and how one identifies oneself within that context.
And that's an extraordinary evolution because, of course, I'm sure you remember from all those ancient decades ago when you and I went to law school ourselves and we learned about things like equal protection. It was built upon an assumption, what I think is commonly called a binary assumption now, that you've got two genders. You got men and you got women. And of course, there's been a lot more nuance in that area that's come out in public in recent years, and gender identity and mixing of genders and crossing of genders has become a reality. And as so often is the case, the law is struggling to keep up with that.
That's right, and I think that's what you see. That's what you see in North Carolina, and I think that, and I think that's what you see in some other states across the nation. How are we going to deal with some of these new issues? in a way that can accommodate people, but also can also reflect democracy. And I think there's a struggle there between constitutional rights and democracy.
There certainly is. And as we all know, one of the most sensitive areas, of course, is the bathroom issue. And I think that's where we left it off. So the city of Charlotte has this fairly progressive or fairly aggressive, if you will, new statute. And what does the state of North Carolina do with its runaway jurisdiction down there?
Well, what's interesting is, like most states, if we think about a state as a sovereign over the physical, you know, sort of geography that it controls, most states are the ultimate decision maker, if you will, with regard to ordinances and laws that their cities pass. And so North Carolina, like other states, has the ultimate power over Charlotte's enactments, their ordinances, and any other towns and municipalities in North Carolina. And there was a quick reaction to Charlotte's decision to extend anti-discrimination protection to LGBT people, and also the transgender bathroom issue. And
before we get there, you said something that's very, very important. Constitutionally speaking, what is the relationship between a state among the 50 states, for example, North Carolina, and its municipalities? And what you've just told me is that one general rule, at least, and if this is also going to depend upon the constitution of that individual state, but one very common rule is that all power, all sovereignty ultimately resides in the state government, and the cities and towns and other municipalities are merely subdivisions of that.
That's correct.
There are other state constitutions that have a much more decentralized decision making, where there's a lot more sovereignty that's been devolved on cities and town. I think it's commonly called a home rule sort of circumstance. Mm-hmm. But North Carolina is not one of those states.
That's correct. And those states that do have home rule, oftentimes that's sort of articulated in either the constitution of the state or by statute, and oftentimes home rule is given to the larger cities within the state. So I'm from Pennsylvania originally, and Philadelphia gets home rule, right? So they have a lot of autonomy, whereas some of the smaller towns and municipalities don't. And so in North Carolina, it appears as though North Carolina doesn't provide home rule rights to its larger cities, and North Carolina as a state retains the ultimate authority over its municipalities and cities.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with my buddy Doug McKechnie from the U.S. Air Force Academy all about the brouhaha over gay rights and transgendered bathroom use down in North Carolina. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Doug. So stick around. Now it's time for our constitutional quiz. This one was recorded live at the senior high school We the People state finals in the great Commonwealth of Virginia in January 2016.
My name is Ryan Walter. I go to Douglas Freeman High School.
All right, Ryan. Ryan from Douglas Freeman High School.
Yes.
Absolutely. And what has been your favorite part of being in We the People this year?
I have to say the teamwork.
The teamwork, tremendous. And do you have a girlfriend on the team?
It's gonna be okay. I'm sorry, what?
Do you have a girlfriend on the team?
My girlfriend on my team? No, I do not.
You do not have a girlfriend on the team? Well, ladies, I think he's a good-looking fellow.
She's over there. She's just not on my team.
Oh, she is here. She is here. Okay. Sorry about that. That's all right. Okay. Well, I'm glad you have a girlfriend. Sorry, she's not on the team.
And, this was not part of the curriculum.
Are you ready for a quiz? Are you ready for a quiz?
Of course.
Okay, you're going to screw it up or you're going to get it right?
I hope so.
One or the other. Okay.
One of those will happen.
One of those will happen. Doug, do you have a really, really hard question for Ryan?
I do, but Ryan's going to knock it out of the park.
You think so?
Well, he's got the pressure of the girlfriend in the room.
Oh, the girlfriend's in the room. Well, he'd better not.
All right, Ryan, here it comes. I'm going to read you the question and give you four options. Are you ready?
Yes.
That's great. What 1803 Supreme Court case established the doctrine of judicial review?
Marbury versus Madison.
He didn't even get to the choices.
I had four choices.
I think that disqualifies him. He didn't even let you ask the whole quiz question.
I thought he was going to go for Miranda, so I was a little surprised.
Oh, okay.
All right. And the good news is, Ryan, because you said the keyword Madison, Young Cash has a...
A special prize.
Indeed, it is a magnet.
A We the People magnet.
A We the People magnet. You are correct. Marbury versus Madison. Ryan, come on up and get
come
your
on up
t-shirt.
And get your
come
swag.
On up, Ryan.
All right.
Good job. Congratulations.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm going to resume my conversation now with Doug McKechnie of the United States Air Force Academy. Before the break, we were talking about the brouhaha down in North Carolina over gay rights. And Doug was explaining that North Carolina vests power in its state government, not in its localities. And that's why, or that's how, the state of North Carolina was able to reverse Charlotte's ordinance protecting LGBT rights.
So when all those wayward people down in Charlotte started doing those crazy things, they now have to reckon with the people in Raleigh. So what did the people in the state capital of Raleigh do?
So about a month later, the General Assembly called the lawmakers back to Raleigh, which is the state capital, for a special session. Interestingly, the governor initially wasn't necessarily interested in a special session, but a special session was called by the legislators, which hadn't been done in over about two decades. So it was sort of a unique situation where the legislative branch called the special session. And after about 2 days after the special session was called, there was a bill introduced, and within about 10 hours it was passed, and it overruled Charlotte's new ordinance banning discrimination against LGBT people. The governor signed it that night, so there was it was a pretty quick turnaround.
That's why they called the session, just to take care of this emerging crisis in Charlotte.
That's it. If you look at the comments that were made at the time, and if you look at the bill, it's pretty clear that it was a special session called in direct response to Charlotte's extension of rights to LGBT people. The bill that was passed not only overturned Charlotte's ban on discrimination, it also specifically prevents any local governments, including Charlotte, from passing their own non-discrimination ordinances that would conflict with the state's non-discrimination ordinances. And so what it said was, the state will be the only arbiter of non-discrimination. We will, as the state, set non-discrimination laws, and no municipalities or cities can go any further.
Well, this sounds remarkably similar to another circumstance. But first, let me just note that it looks, at least at first glance, as if the state government, acting primarily, it seems, through the state legislature, has pretty much crushed Charlotte's attempt to have this anti-discrimination statute. And that's what reminds me of a similar victory by anti-gay rights forces back in the 1990s in Colorado. And I'm thinking of a case, Romer versus Evans, in which there was a referendum in the state of Colorado, which did some fairly similar things. And on a statewide basis, it repealed pretty much all local ordinances that were designed to protect sexual orientation as a protected category, and then banned any of them from being done in the future. And it was a constitutional amendment that really just shut down gay rights advocates in the state of Colorado. So in some sense, because it was constitutional and because it was this blanket prohibition, it went further than what I'm hearing you talking about in North Carolina. But it does seem that the North Carolina action was fairly similar to that.
I think that's what the that's what those who are filing a lawsuit challenging North Carolina's actions are going to argue, and I think it could be a convincing argument, and you're right. And so in the Colorado circumstance, in Romer versus Evans, they actually enacted a constitutional amendment that prohibited that these sorts of ordinances and laws that that gave anti-discrimination protection for homosexuals as a protected class. And so
right.
there could be an analogy there.
I think there might be. Now, I'm just speaking off the top of my head, but that Romer is an often overlooked case from 1996 that in many respects is sort of the first great gay rights case at the Supreme Court. And no surprise, it was written by Justice Kennedy. But what was notable about it was that that very strong victory for the opposing forces, those opposed to gay rights, might have been a little bit too much of a victory because it was overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. It was overturned because the court found it served no legitimate purpose. It didn't even pass the lowest level of judicial scrutiny. And in fact, Kennedy basically went on to say the only justification he could see for such a constitutional amendment in Colorado was what he termed anti-gay animus, translated into normal speak, bigotry. Basically, the court was saying you have no business passing laws like this in the state of Colorado, such sweeping rejections of any sort of gay rights statute. And that was a pretty strong precedent, and that's still good law. So I'm kind of wondering whether the governor and legislature of North Carolina might be running smack up against Romer.
I think that's going to be one of the arguments with regard to whether or not this reaction by North Carolina is constitutional, is this idea that and certainly the challengers to the law are going to cite to comments made by legislators about why this law was passed. Certainly there are derogatory comments about LGBT people right before the passage of the law. And so I think the argument is going to be, look, North Carolina passed this law, so North Carolina's argument is going to be, well, you know, we need consistency among the state. We need to make sure that businesses know whether you're in Charlotte or any other city, what the discrimination laws are. And so that idea of a consistent law is useful to the businesses in North Carolina and others who might want to deny services to people. The response is, as you mentioned in Romer versus Evans, anytime a state is acting or a government is acting in a way that is simply motivated by animus towards a particular group of people and really has no other purpose, that is going to be analyzed under the lowest level of scrutiny, and it's going to be presumed almost to be unconstitutional under the Equal Protection Clause. And also, Romer gives way to the Windsor case.
Oh, yeah, lots of gay rights cases since then.
Sure. And Windsor, which is the Defense of Marriage Act case, Justice Kennedy again talks a lot about how the Defense of Marriage Act that was passed by the federal government and essentially preempted states that recognized gay marriage, that the Defense of Marriage Act was motivated again by animus towards homosexuals and their state legitimized relationships. And so, again, that idea of a prohibition, a constitutional, federal constitutional prohibition on laws that are really simply focused on disabling a group of people and really no other reason.
Right. And then, of course, we have to note that just this last year was Obergefell, another major victory for gay rights people. And, you know, it's and the willingness of the courts to enforce that to the point of actually jailing court clerks who have been unwilling to issue marriage licenses to gay couples. So the courts have been pretty strong on gay rights. The federal courts have been pretty strong on gay rights. And so I think maybe there's going to be some very significant grounds for challenging this North Carolina statute. At least the part we've talked about thus far. The part that is the most controversial, though, is the so-called bathroom part. And I think there are some arguments on both sides of that. What does North Carolina argue about that transgender bathroom use bill?
So North Carolina's argument is we as a state, we as the government of North Carolina, are concerned that if you open up bathrooms to transgendered people or essentially allowing people to use whatever bathroom they choose, regardless of the sex that is assigned to them on their birth certificate, that will give way to predators, particularly men is who are often the focus of this argument. Men are going to pretend to be women or take advantage of these laws and go in and you know, either rape or somehow sexually abuse children or women in the women's room. And so the idea is that opening up restrooms to essentially anyone who recognizes their gender as comporting with the restroom that they choose could really pose a danger.
Well, let me just pause there. And I have to say I've spoken to several women about this issue. And these are not women who are people I would consider at all bigoted. In fact, many of them are big supporters of gay rights and transgendered rights generally. But they've expressed discomfort with the idea that someone who was born a man and who may still, in fact, have male sexual characteristics, because we should note that not all transgendered people actually have sex reassignment surgery. So you might have someone in the bathroom who is biologically male. And I think they're less concerned about people who genuinely are transgendered than they are about the situation that you've just described. Some man who decides, a heterosexual man perhaps, who decides that he now has license to dress up like a woman, go into the bathroom, and then in that private place somehow abuse or spy on or photograph or otherwise invade the privacy or other rights of women. They're uncomfortable with this. And I wonder if that's a fairly strong argument that North Carolina might be able to prevail. And sort of, it's sort of a public safety argument. And when the government makes a public safety argument, courts are typically pretty deferential to that.
And so I think that that's a concern that people have articulated. The response to the argument is there are over, I think, about 200 cities and municipalities that essentially have the same law that allow transgender people to use the bathroom that comports with their gender identity.
I did not know that. I did not know that it was that widespread.
There are quite a few. Yeah, there are a lot of major cities have these laws. And the argument is that there is no uptick in the sort of events occurring that you're articulating. And in addition, the states that most states already have on the books laws that prevent people from using the bathroom in a way that would harass other people or take pictures of them or obviously engage in sexual assault. And so the argument is, look, you've already got laws on the books that would prevent people from doing the thing that you're concerned these people might do.
Yeah, and I guess, again, this is getting kind of unpleasant to contemplate, but I guess if I wanted to go into a woman's bathroom and harass her now, I could either simply wait until no one was looking and then go in and hide in a stall with, I don't know, my camera or whatever I'm going to do, or if I'm going to assault somebody, just, you know, hide behind the door or something and wait for someone to come in and then do all my nefarious activities. I don't necessarily need to dress up like a woman to do that or to pretend to be transgendered to do that. Now, that might give me some degree of camouflage, but if I'm a bad actor, I'm going to figure out a way to assault a woman in a public restroom, and this really isn't going to enhance my ability to do so significantly.
Right, and the reality is that those who challenge the law, the reality is that there hasn't been a significant uptick in these sorts of crimes with people pretending to be transgendered. And you know, apart from the public safety argument, there is a constitutional argument that those who challenge these laws rely on. The first one is that you're essentially classifying people and treating them differently based on their biological sex. And so non-transgendered people are able to access restrooms that are consistent with their gender, whereas transgendered people are banned from using those bathrooms that conform with their gender identity. And so we're sort of picking and choosing and treating people differently based on sex, their sex organs. And as you know, that's subject to what we call intermediate scrutiny under the Equal Protection Clause.
Right. Yeah. It's a heightened level of judicial scrutiny that I guess we really haven't seen a lot of Supreme Court cases, none that I'm aware of, and not that many federal cases that specifically address transgendered issues. And so I guess it's possible that they'd apply a different level of scrutiny, though that does seem to be the appropriate one because we are talking about gender in some respect here. Yeah. That is the opposite argument. I mean, on the one side, you've got the public safety issue, which, as you say, doesn't seem to be borne out by the facts. And then on the other side, you've got the individual rights of a transgendered person who wants to use a restroom where he or she is most comfortable and consistent with his or her identity. And the courts are going to have to take that into account.
They are. And one of the other – actually two other interesting arguments that those who are challenging the law bring up is first, in North Carolina, the only way that you can use a bathroom is if that bathroom comports with the sex that you were assigned when you were born. Well, mm-hmm. in North Carolina, if you're transgendered, the only way you can get your birth certificate changed to reflect the gender that you identify with is if you actually have sex organ reassignment surgery. And so you actually have the surgery that to create your sexual organs to, right. to reflect your gender.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not necessarily what is prescribed by for all transgendered people. So
right, not everybody wants to, right?
Right, and so that's one sort of hurdle, and there are certainly court cases that prohibit states from forcing individuals to have medical treatment that they don't want, and so that's sort of an interesting issue or interesting argument that may come up.
But you might be effectively forcing them to do things they don't necessarily want to do. Yeah, and then of course there's a whole issue of enforcement. I saw an editorial cartoon recently, and it was there've been lots of them. North Carolina's been taking a beating about this in the press and on social media, and it showed this rather unpleasant looking guard standing outside of a women's room, and she had some sort of mirror on the ground that she was apparently going to look up women's dresses to assess their genitalia on the way into the women's room, you know, to make sure that they had the appropriate genitalia. Before they could go into the women's room. And of course, nobody enforces this now. You don't have guards outside of women's rooms doors or men's rooms door. It's mostly it's just a matter of social enforcement. Men don't walk into women's room and women don't walk into men's room as a general rule. So how could you enforce something like this? If a transgendered person Bruce Jenner, I guess Caitlyn Jenner. If you look at her, she looks like a woman. So she's walking into a woman's room. What are you going to say? You look a little too masculine to me. I better check you out.
I think that's right. And I think another argument that those who are challenging the law make is that if that was what was required or in practice, that's what happened, that would be a violation of our right to privacy under the 14th Amendment.
Yeah, I can't imagine too many people, men or women, enjoying having their genitals checked in and out of the bathroom.
Right. And the Supreme Court has multiple times when trying to figure out where this right to privacy that we have, although it's not specifically articulated in the Constitution, you know, the court has over and over again talked about the idea that, you know, we really do have a right to autonomy and dignity, and even within the context of the bedroom our decisions to use contraception, lots of decisions that we make with regard to our sexuality and our sexual organs are protected under the Constitution, and that. The argument goes that would extend to our use of the restroom, and if we're required to somehow reveal the sexual organs we have when we use the restroom, well, that would be a violation of information that's really sensitive and personal.
My bathroom is a private kind of place, very special kind of place.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm having a perfectly fascinating discussion with Doug McKechnie of the Law Department at the United States Air Force Academy all about gay rights and transgendered issues, most specifically down in the state of North Carolina, where the state recently reversed an ordinance protecting gay rights that had been passed by the city of Charlotte. After the break, we'll finish our conversation with Doug, so stick around. And now it's time to finish our discussion with Doug McKechnie of the United States Air Force Academy, all about God, gay rights, and Governor McCrory of the great state of North Carolina.
And just thinking now beyond the Constitution, but the practicalities, many, I'm sure not all, but many transgendered people dress and otherwise alter their appearance to be consistent with the identity that they feel. So if I'm a guy who decides that he is really a woman and I transition, then I'll be wearing women's clothing and I will have changed my appearance to minimize my masculine features. And so for the most part, I will look like a woman, at least to the casual observer. If North Carolina has its way, then I, looking like a woman, have to go in and out of the men's room. And the opposite is true.
I was going to say, yeah.
Looking like a man has to go into the women's room. It might cause more of a ruckus.
Exactly. I think that's one of the – from a practical perspective, that's one of the arguments is if the sex that's assigned to me on my birth certificate is a woman, but I identify – my gender identity is a man, and I'm taking, for example, hormone therapy, and I have facial hair. Perhaps I had other surgery, like a mastectomy. I'm going to be required to use the women's room, and what's the reaction going to be? And the other practical argument is, what if I work at a building that has only men and women's room? And so, you know, I don't want to walk into the bathroom that will cause the ruckus that people might be concerned about. And so I've got to somehow leave my building and find perhaps a bathroom that it doesn't have an assigned sex to it, you know, maybe in a restaurant or something. And so it could cause a lot of practical problems for people who find themselves unable to use the bathroom that would most clearly sort of correspond with their gender identity.
My. As a good friend of mine who is an ardent feminist said some time ago, it always comes down to bathrooms. She was actually referring all the way back to the 70s and the debates over the Equal Rights Amendment. And, you know, people always talk about bathrooms. But this woman laughs and she said, think about it. Most bathrooms you use are unisex bathrooms. Think of the bathrooms in your own house. Women use them and men use them. They share them in some sense. Think of most of the bathrooms and most of the places you've been. It's just really public restrooms we're talking about. And I don't know. I guess it's just a sensitive subject. Well, where do you think it's going to go? I mean, who's filed? I imagine there have been lawsuits filed. I know there have been lots of public protests.
There have been a lot of public protests. There have been business reactions. I think over 80 businesses have reacted to it, businesses like Apple and Microsoft. And so, you know, I think
In fact, wasn't it PayPal that had a big expansion it had planned? Was it in Charlotte or was it in Raleigh?
I think it was in Charlotte.
I think it was in Charlotte and said it was several hundred jobs. And I think they were relatively well-paying jobs, and they simply announced we're not going to expand. And then I think it was Bruce Springsteen who just announced, and Ringo Starr, that they were not going to perform in North Carolina. So there has been a huge amount of very high-profile public protest.
And you know, it's one of those things I think that you and I often think about the constitutional aspect of these sorts of questions, but mm-hmm. the reality is sometimes the public outcry and reaction can be just as there can be just as much of effect from those sorts of reactions as the lawsuits. But there is a lawsuit that's been filed by the American Civil Liberties Union, and the plaintiffs, the people who are challenging the law, are two transgendered men whose birth certificate indicate that their sex assigned at birth was female.
Let's just pause a minute because people, sure. This is confusing. This is new for a lot of people, especially old fogies like me. So these are two people who started out biologically as women, who decided that they felt that they really were men, and so they've transitioned, and now they consider themselves men. And that's actually probably one of the situations that could cause the most ruckus. Now these men want to – no, excuse me. Now they're transgendered men. Probably cause less ruckus because they'll be going into men's rooms, right?
That's what they want to do. They'd like to go into men's rooms because right. that's the gender they identify with. However, they haven't had the sex reassignment surgery, and so they're going to be required, because their birth certificate says they're female, and they haven't had a chance to, nor will they be able to get their birth certificate changed if they don't have sex reassignment surgery, which is obviously, you know, it could be a cost to people. They might not be able to afford it. They might not.
Very personal choice.
Sure. It might not be part of their treatment for their gender identity. So now they have to use a female bathroom. So you could imagine, again, what we were talking about earlier, they're going to, while they may have hormone therapy that causes them to have facial hair and have other masculine sort of physical traits, they're going to have to walk into a women's room.
But you know what? I think this might be – I'm just guessing here. I don't know. Have you heard – is this part of a strategy? I mean, whenever you have a cause that you're trying to put forward as a as an interest group, you always try to pick the most sympathetic or the least threatening plaintiffs. It occurs to me these are the less threatening of the two situations. These are biological women who transition to being male who want to go into a men's room. And I wonder if the ACLU thinks that that will be a less threatening scenario than the opposite.
Well, what's interesting, I think, and you know, I think we have a lot of cases, really significant cases throughout constitutional law history, going back to Plessy versus Ferguson, where the plaintiff is chosen for a particular reason. And of course, I can't speak on behalf of the plaintiffs or the ACLU, but it seems to me that one of the questions that this requires us to struggle with is exactly what we've been talking about. So, you know, these particular plaintiffs who have been chosen because they look like men. I presume they look like men because they're taking hormone therapy and dressing like men. We would expect men to dress. You know, the outcome of this law is, look at these people. They are going to be walking into the women's room because their birth certificate says.
Yeah, and that will cause a ruckus.
Yeah.
These people who look like men, and forgive me, I don't mean to mischaracterize it, but these people who have transitioned to men but are biologically female, they'll cause a ruckus going into a women's room. Whereas quite frankly, as a general – I think it's a reasonable observation. It's much less of a big deal if a woman comes into a men's room. In fact, most of us who have been to a rock concert or to a very crowded venue have occasionally – most of us men have been in the men's room, and we've seen some very embarrassed-looking woman come in and rush to one of the stalls because she couldn't get in to the women's room because the line was too long. And though that doesn't happen too frequently, for the most part, it's not a big deal and – it happens quickly and it's all over with. But if a man goes rushing into a women's room for similar legitimate reasons that he's got to go and he's got no – he can't get into the men's room, that would cause a ruckus.
Exactly. And I
think they've picked their plaintiffs very well.
They have. And so those are the plaintiffs that will be able to make the argument that the bathroom law it causes constitutional issues. And then there's also a woman who is a lesbian who can be the plaintiff who is arguing the animus argument with regard to North Carolina's reaction to anti-discrimination to Charlotte's anti-discrimination ordinance. And so there's a couple different plaintiffs who will be able to make allegations that this North Carolina law that was sort of passed as a package has some sort of negative effect on them one way or the other.
Doug, when you come on the show, it's either dirty language or now we're talking about potties. You always pick the most interesting topic.
I guess I'm the go-to person for those subjects.
Yep, you are absolutely. We have to talk about the potties now. Okay, what's your crystal ball tell you?
Well, you know, I will say that I think one of the really fascinating and strong arguments is the animus argument. And we've seen the Supreme Court, particularly with Justice Kennedy over the last couple years, really pen some decisions that are particularly in the context of laws that are reactions to LGBT issues, you know, pen some decisions that have been very protective and really extending specific protection to LGBT people. So, you know, whether this ends up in the Supreme Court or not is a question that I can't answer and none of us can, but very, very fascinating arguments that they can make and potentially strong arguments.
Yeah, I think so. And I think so much of it is up in the air right now. Of course, we've just lost Justice Scalia. Rest in peace. We're in a confrontation now and a stalemate over his replacement. So much depends upon what the Senate does over the next 6 to 8 months, and certainly the outcome of the presidential race and the race for the Senate, and whether the balance changes from Republican to Democratic, and who ultimately gets on the court. So with all those variables, any sort of ultimate prediction becomes almost an exercise in futility. I would say I tend to think that the court has definitely been pointing in the direction of gay rights. And even if a Republican wins and the Republicans control the Senate, that won't really change the balance because Scalia was an ardent opponent of such things. So I think chances are more that we would go the opposite direction, with one big caveat, and that is that I'm not sure that the Supreme Court is quite as sympathetic to issues of gender identity and transgendered issues on the one hand versus sexual orientation on the other, because that's not exactly the same thing.
Right, and I certainly didn't mean to lump them together.
No, of course. Most people – I mean, we do, LGBT, right? We're sort of lumping them together in the acronym. But sometimes we have to pull that acronym apart and say, you know, it's one – you know, gay rights has had a remarkable evolution over the past 30 or 40 years. Just the last 20 years, the last 10 years, it's just been extraordinary. It's only been 13 years since we had criminal statutes outlawing sodomy on the books. So, I mean, it's just been a remarkable transformation, but gay is one thing and transgender is another, and people may simply have a different or maybe a stronger reaction to it.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's actually one of the questions, and other district courts or sort of trial court level, the lowest level of courts, other courts have tried to deal with it as well, but one of the unanswered questions that we have that the court is probably going to have to deal with at some point in the future is, under the Equal Protection Clause, how are we going to look at the government's decision to categorize and treat people differently based on their transgender status? And so if the government is picking and choosing government benefits or treating people differently in some way because of their transgender status, is that going to be like treating people differently based on their race, which is the highest scrutiny level, the most easily rejected classification under the Constitution? Is it more like gender sex discrimination, or treating people differently based on sex? Or is it something else? Is it the lowest level of scrutiny, treating people differently based on their height or the size of their shoes, which is something the government can do without having to pass any heightened scrutiny? And so that's something the court, I think, is going to have to answer, whether it's through this case or another. It's something that's going to be presented to the court, I think, sooner than later.
Well, it just gets curiouser and curiouser, but it's always interesting. And Doug McKechnie of the United States Air Force Academy, do you want to give your disclaimer again?
Thank you. Yes, I will, Stuart. My views are my own and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the United States Air Force, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.
Thanks, Doug.
Thanks, Stuart.
Hey, it looks like we got a couple of minutes left, so why don't we hear from Lauren Carroll, our friend at PolitiFact.
Well, Lauren Carroll, are you making difficulty for some public figure again?
They're making the difficulty for themselves, I would say. We're just here to document.
You're already becoming a true journalist. It's not your fault, it's their fault. Okay, well, who's making constitutional claims today that you're checking on?
This is an oldie but goodie. It's Herman Cain.
I remember Herman Cain.
Yeah, he ran for president on the Republican side in 2012. Mm-hmm. Didn't make it past the primary, but was a pretty popular public figure. And back at the time, he made a couple claims about the Constitution that we fact-checked.
What did Mr. Cain claim about our Constitution?
He said, in the U.S. Constitution, that, quote, there's a little section in there that talks about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Oh, no. Yep. I hear this all the time. You know, but I'm going to let you tell. What's the problem with that claim?
Well, you know, this language is familiar, and for maybe people who haven't spent a ton of time reading our founding documents. They hear it and they know that it came from our founding fathers, but they don't know exactly where it came from. But the clause about life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness was not from the Constitution. It was from the Declaration of Independence. In his speech, he said something about we have the right to abolish the government as citizens, but that also is from the Declaration of Independence when Thomas Jefferson was saying, "Hi, Britain. We want to abolish this government and create our own." So he's got it wrong there. He's got his documents mixed up.
Or in the immortal words of Mr. Spicoli from Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
What Jefferson was saying was, hey, you know, we left this England place because it was bogus. So if we don't get some cool rules ourselves, pronto, we'll just be bogus too.
That's what the Declaration of Independence was about. It was about abolishing a government, or at least declaring our independence from it. And that's why that language was so important. It was, as Jefferson said, we're going to justify what we're doing. We're going to explain to the world why it's important for us to declare our independence despite these political bands that have held us together for so long. And that's a very different document from a constitution.
Exactly. And I think, you know, there's an argument to be made that the reasons why we declared independence and the feelings behind that declaration played out in the constitution, in the government that they created. But that doesn't mean that those immortal words are physically in that document.
And there are several different levels of criticism. The one that you pointed out in your piece, that perhaps from a legal perspective, the most important distinction between these two documents is that the Constitution is law.
Right.
I mean, the Constitution is our fundamental law, and it's the one that courts will frequently cite when they're making decisions. It's the one we have to obey. Whereas the Declaration is a marvelous piece of rhetoric and an extremely important document, but it's not law. There are a lot of very important issues here that go beyond just the legal, non-legal distinction that we just mentioned. And that is the difference between revolution and constitutionalism. Now, we had to have the revolution in order to have the establishment of a new government, but those are two different things. And often today in current politics, I will see people making references to revolutionary thoughts like we need to abolish the government, or you know, the government's been oppressing us, therefore it's time for us to revolt. Well, not exactly. I mean, 11 years after we had our independence, we went out and established our own government of us, the people. And, you know, maybe the time for revolution passed. And, you know, maybe we should be talking more about the Constitution today and a little bit less about the Declaration. At any rate, Lauren, I appreciate your clarifying that.
No problem. And one little funny note that I want to leave with is that the full quote that Herman Cain said was, "I know that there are some people that are not going to reread the Constitution and enforce the Constitution. So for benefit for those that are not going to read it because they don't want to go by the Constitution, there's a little section in there that talks about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness."
Oh, boy.
And then we had a funny quote from a scholar that helped us out with this piece who said, "It might be a good thing if Mr. Cain would undertake that task," talking about reading the Constitution.
Well, I agree with that wholeheartedly, and even though he's not running for president anymore, we'd be happy to send Mr. Cain a copy of the Constitution. So if you want one, Herman, give us a call.
All I need are some tasty waves, cool buzz, and I'm fine.
And that's our show. Thanks so much to Lauren Carroll and all of our friends at PolitiFact. They always do their homework, and they share it with us, and we appreciate it. Thanks also to Doug McKechnie of the United States Air Force Academy for sharing with us his perspectives on that brouhaha down in North Carolina all about gay rights. Those things are very current all across the nation, and it's a fascinating topic. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the fifes and drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.